This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
And Lavinka.
Summer Iman.
And Glenn Holt. And on tonight's show, Life on the Down Low. That's what it's called when men have sex with men but don't openly identify as gay or bisexual. Many are involved with men and women but don't disclose their sexual orientation to their partners. According to the Centers for Disease Control, the secretive nature of this behavior increases the risk for sexually transmitted infections, including HIV. Tim Jones works at the Montrose Counseling Center trying to lower risk behavior among African-American men who have sex with men. We'll talk with him about being on the down low. Then at 9:30, it's News Wrap from This Way Out. In the news tonight, students are protesting a letter sent to state universities by Virginia's Attorney General Ken Cuccinelli, ordering them to drop sexual orientation from their anti-bias policies. And a Roman Catholic school in Boulder, Colorado, says two young children are no longer welcome as students because they have two mothers. After News Wrap, Republicans for Inclusion is a newly formed Houston area group of Republican and conservative activists who believe that the Republican Party should reach out to all people, regardless of sexual orientation or gender identity. Christopher Busby will be our guest for that topic. At the top of our second hour, Joan Devlin interviews the author of a book about daring to be different. Martha Micaiah Hart offers us a compelling picture of the agony and the ecstasy that are the rewards of choosing one's personal truth. At 10:20, Eric Rowland of Legacy Health Services will be here to talk about new data analysis released by the CDC, which shows a stark discrepancy between rates of HIV and syphilis infection among gay and bisexual men relative to the rest of the U.S. population. And we have our regular feature segments from This Way Out. Tonight, Who We Are musically protests the U.S. military's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy, and the conclusion of a series about the state of GLBT rights in Africa.
It is time to be counted. There is census forms are arriving shortly. I got mine today.
I got mine today, too.
Well, I guess you're in the outlying area. Did you get your notice? You're going to get yours.
I will get mine. I got that last. I got that on Saturday.
Okay.
The Saturday notice that I would, in fact, be getting it.
The last 2 weeks, we did segments on the census and how important it was. On last Thursday, was it? They had, or Wednesday? Everything merges together. The form was at MCCR Church, and it was a very good form. And you know, our people sometimes ask tough questions, and we did ask some tough questions. But the census people that were there, including, if I understand this correctly, the head of the census in the Dallas region, which we're part of, was
right
there. The unfortunate thing is they're not counting GLBT people in particular. That's not happening in this census.
Mm-mm.
What had happened was, in a previous or the previous one before that census, when they wanted to count unmarried couples, the consequence was they were counting GLBT couples, same-sex couples.
Right.
Because when you fill out the form, you said, your name, your sex, the second person's name and sex and relationship, and when you said husband or wife and same sex. And what happened, though, is they sort of threw that out as being GLBT couples, but being same-sex couples.
Discrimination.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they didn't really. I mean, the numbers are still there. And what's really important to know also is that the raw data is kept secret for 72 years. The NGLTF, National Gay Lesbian Task Force, are giving away stickers that you can put on the outside envelope that saying you're a GLBT, that's the queer census or something like that, count the queers, or it's something that they're doing.
Okay. It's queer the census. It's a pink sticker. And it's just as big and gay as you can be and says, I'm here, I'm queer, and this is my census form.
They don't want you to put it actually on the form because that form gets fed into an optical reader, and that would only screw it up. Now, you could, if you want to, write on the form that you're GLBT, although that will not be counted. But 72 years from now, when they actually do look at that stuff again.
They'll say, GLBT people.
Why do we care that the gays are counted?
Well, because the conservatives say we're like 1% of the population. You know, we don't really know. And, of course, you know, there's
that's
also
still 35
that,
million people. And we've always
no,
heard...
No, that's 10% in it.
We've always heard 10%.
Yeah.
So we're arguing for our percentage, I guess.
And
maybe it's more.
We also know that even when they were counting GLBT, or where they're counting same-sex couples, that still was an undercount. Because if you don't live in the same household, you're not counted as a same-sex couple. Because the way the system... They want to count people in the household.
Right.
And a lot of people don't want to be counted because they're afraid of the confidentiality or where they live or stuff like
that. Big brother.
But actually, the numbers in the past census were much higher than what they expected. So it is important. Well, first of all, it's important to do the census because Texas is probably going to get three, possibly four new congressional districts.
Absolutely, that's vitally important.
More power for Texas, and there is money tied to that. Money that comes back into Texas, back into Houston, is very important, so the more people that's counted. One of the things that they don't do on the census is ask if you're a citizen. That's not what the census is supposed to do.
And people need to understand that. This isn't ICE or anything. This is just the census. All they want to do is count the heads.
So, that arrives. It should be arriving shortly if you didn't get it already. Fill it out honestly. Send it back. And make sure you count everybody. Don't count your pets, but if you got it, you know, if there's
fur people, do not count on this census.
Make sure you fill it out to everybody who's living in your household because they basically want to take a snapshot of where everybody is on April 1st so that they could do their best to be able to count people. And the raw data is not seen by anybody. In the history of the census, this stuff has never gotten out. But the numbers are important so that when the reapportionment of money going back into the district, it's really important that we are counted. And it's been said that Houston has been undercount. Of course, every city probably says that, but being such a mobile population of the GLBT community is, being that Houston is a place where a lot of people didn't come from, they moved here.
That's right.
They may not think it's as important. It is very important.
It's vitally important, especially those people who have migrated to our city and haven't, they've set down roots, but they really haven't found their place here. You need to put the information down on it. And it's important if you've heard any of the right-wing naysayers that come on the radios. We know who they are.
Glenn, you have an announcement, don't you?
Yes, I do, actually. You handed me this so hot off the press, as it were. Come hear the stories of life on the streets of Houston people who have been there. Come to the evening presentation that's called, this is a long name, Sharing Our Stories, Experiences, Perspectives, and Ideas from Folks Who Have Been Homeless and from Their Allies. Speakers include Joseph Benson, who lost his legs in a car wreck and was homeless for 4 years. Now Benson is a leader in the National Homeless Consumer Movement and spearheading a voter registration drive among the homeless in Houston. Sharing Our Stories will occur on two dates, Tuesday, March 16th, that's tomorrow, 7 p.m., at the Live Oak Friends Meeting House, 1318 West 26th Street, and Friday, March 19th, 7:30 p.m. at the Houston Institute for Culture, and that's at 708 Telephone Road, next to Bohemos Coffee House. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. said, quote, "Men often hate each other because they fear each other. They fear each other because they don't know each other. They don't know each other because they cannot communicate. They cannot communicate because they are separated." For more information on Sharing Our Stories, go to www.upwards.blogspot.com or call 832-865-3343. This is a Understanding Poverty project, and it's co-sponsored by Search, Healthcare for the Homeless Houston, and the Live Oaks Friends Meeting. And, of course, you can Google any one of those things if you have a computer and you're at home connected to the Internet or on your iPhone or whatever. It's called Sharing Our Stories. Just Google that, and it's one of the meetings either tomorrow evening or Friday evening here in Houston.
I also want to talk a little bit, just a little bit, about the musical South Pacific that's playing down at the Hobby Center, which the Hobby Center is like just a jewel of a great place to see a play. The tickets are rather expensive because it's a very professional play, but South Pacific, which was written in the, you know, late 40s, early 50s, still is very topical because the underlying theme about South Pacific is dealing with people who are different. And one of the wonderful songs near the end, and there's just great songs within there, but the whole story is so good, talks about how people are taught prejudice when they're young. And I understand that when the show first came out in the 50s, in fact, I understand when it was in New Haven, before it went to Broadway, one of the New York critics says, "I don't want this to come to Broadway because it's too good for Broadway."
Oh.
But the other thing is that, and it's just the people in there are just fabulous, and of course the songs are fabulous, but the whole underlying theme, and that when the show first came out, it was very controversial because it was dealing with those themes of different people.
I can't believe you're talking about Broadway and with me outside the studio. But you know, the revival recently on Broadway had Matthew Morrison, the star of Glee, as the lead actor, as the lead role. Before Glee hit, so... You know, I missed it before, you know. He was all popular and star-rific.
On stage, yes.
On stage.
And it runs through the 21st. If you're interested, you can call 713-558-TUTS, T-U-T-S. It's at the Hobby Center. You're listening to Queer Voices.
Is it any wonder that I'm making for you in a crowded room? We've been undercover and it's making me sick to have to bury it. You into me accidentally.
That was Christy Strummel and a song called Best Kiss. It's actually a privately released thing that was recorded this year, and we got it from J.D. Doyle. This is Queer Voices.
We have Chris Busby with us tonight, and he is starting a new group. And what is that group, Chris?
The group is Republicans for Inclusion. It was formed back in December, though we really haven't gone public with our group till recently, probably within the past couple of months.
And why do you feel the need to have a group like this?
Well, because we feel that there's a lack of outreach to the Republican Party within the GLBT community. We also are unhappy with the current party platform.
Okay.
We seek to, hopefully, this is a long-term goal. We're not hoping that it's going to happen within the next year or anything like that. But we seek to amend the party platform to be more inclusive to all communities.
Well, the reality was is the Democratic Party wasn't very open to GLBT people 30 years ago either, when people started getting involved. Why did you not work under the national group, the Log Cabin Republicans?
Well, we did consider branding ourselves with the Log Cabin name. We considered it at many different occasions. We looked at the positives and the negatives. And in the end, we felt that we wanted a fresh start. Within the party, there is a sense of negativity towards the Log Cabin Republicans. And we wanted a way to be able to reach into the community without those past burdens that that come with that organization.
And what do you, so some of the negatives of the national group, do they actually have chapters? Or because I thought I read somewhere that they were sort of consolidating some of their chapters and closing them down. Because there was a couple different tries here in Houston to have a Houston chapter.
There was. It closed back about, I think about 5 years ago. There used to be a chapter here in Houston that was very active, and there used to be chapters all over Texas. The only one that I know of now is the Dallas branch, which is still fairly strong.
Have you talked to them at all?
Yes, we have been in communication with them.
And are they encouraging you?
They're encouraging our group in general, and they did talk to us about the possibility of affiliating with Log Cabin, but again, that's just not what we chose to go with.
And do you, so is this going to be strictly a Republican party type of working within Republican Party? Are you going to be open to other parties, or you want to focus on the Republican Party?
We do want to focus on the Republican Party. We're open to anybody who wants to come and help us, be they Democrat or conservative or independent or moderate or what be they. If they want to help us to work within the Republican Party, then they're welcome. But we do only endorse Republican candidates.
So you're going to actually endorse? You're going to become a PAC?
At this point, we haven't had any money spent, so there hasn't been.
You're not this time, but are you looking in the future to possibly becoming a political action committee?
Yes, we are looking into that, and we do have one endorsement. We have endorsed in the State Representative District 134. We've endorsed the Republican nominee, Sarah Davis.
And who's presently in that district?
Ellen Cohen.
Okay. Was when you talked to the candidates, were they welcoming?
Yes. Sarah has been an excellent candidate who's been very open to us. We've been helping out with her campaign in various ways that we can without spending money, by volunteering and whatnot. And she's been a great friend, a great ally, a great supporter.
What about the other Republican candidates?
Well, we have talked to other candidates. None have asked for our help in the primary, and we have yet to make endorsements for the general election and save for in Sarah's race.
So does your group plan to also get active within the party? In other words, going to the party meetings, going to, just as people got involved in the Democratic Party, going to state Senate. I'm guessing they have sort of the same parallel as Democratic Party with state Senate conventions and a state convention, mm-hmm. and then onward to the national convention. Is that true?
Yes, we have. Most of our members are active in some way with the party. I know I'm going to the state Senate district conventions this weekend, and we have everything from precinct chairs in our group to Tea Party activists, even people who have run for office before. So, I mean, we have a great variety of people in our group.
How's been the general reception within the Republican Party?
Honestly, not much yet. I think it's mostly because we're still a small group, and I would assume most people just don't know about us.
What are you doing to be known within the party itself, other than what we were talking about, going to the Senate campaigns? And when you get there, are you going to do anything in particular to be noticed?
Such as trying to pass resolutions?
This time around, we do not. We're not attempting to pass any resolutions just because we don't think they could pass. We would hope so in the future, but it's not a goal for us this cycle. But we are hoping to build relationships within the party and make that a long-term goal.
Now, one of the things that I used to believe that the Republican Party stood for was to sort of keep your hands off people's sex lives. And that seems to not happen in the last sort of decade. Is that one of the goals you want to move towards? Would you really like to see the Republican Party embrace GLBT people or just say, live and let be?
Well, I mean, there's several Republican leaders, conservative leaders like Barry Goldwater and Representative Ron Paul, who have supported various GLBT causes. Now, I haven't heard of them blanket endorse, you know, causes. They look at each issue and evaluate how best it is to minimize the government's role in people's lives. But there have been several candidates and public officials who have stood up for us. Unfortunately, we don't feel that those people have been supported. And that's one of the goals of our organization, is to have some type of support for those people who do stand up.
Now, do you plan, your meetings, are they open?
Yes, our meetings are open to the general public. One of our problems is we haven't selected a permanent location yet, so. But anybody who is interested in finding out more about our meetings is welcome to come to our website and sign up on our contact list.
And what's that website?
The website is www.republicansforinclusion.com, all one word.
Okay, so what prompted you to get into, I'm going to start my own organization? There's always a motive, there's always something behind that stimulated you, some passion that got you, said, you know, I'm going to join with my friends and start a new organization. What was that prompting?
Well, I was, and still am, a member of the Houston GLBT Political Caucus. However, I was frustrated that they are a nonpartisan group, however, rarely endorse Republicans. They've only endorsed one Republican within the past decade, and even though several strong Republican leaders have stood up and sought the caucus endorsement, including Councilmember Stephen Costello, former Councilmember Pam Holm, so we felt that these people deserved some GLBT support, especially from the Republican community, but our voice wasn't being heard.
So you just decided that you would go out and start your organization?
Essentially.
Well, I mean, I hear that, well, that they're nonpartisan, but yet they didn't endorse Republicans. I guess my question is, that was the impetus to go out and start another one. Why not work within the group?
Well, several of us have been trying to work within the group, and we didn't feel like we were making any headway. And honestly, most of us in the group consider ourselves conservative or very conservative and don't feel that our time and money is best spent when 99 out of 100 candidates endorsed are Democrats.
Yeah. Did you sense a animus within the group?
I don't know about an animus. Maybe a general hostility, but not specifically towards ourselves.
So what are your plans? You're starting out small group. About how many members? I mean, you're building up from the grassroots.
Well, we have about 10 official members,
That's fine.
Who are interested. I mean, we've had several different people come to our meetings, try to find out more about our group. And ultimately, we're just recruiting new members right now. That's our main goal, is to build up our organization so we can help out those who would help us.
Are you on Facebook?
Yes, we are on Facebook. We have a fan page.
Are you trying to work with some other organizations within the Republican Party? Because I'm sure there are a lot of different organizations.
You know, we haven't yet. We've talked about it. It's a possibility. We'd love to work with any organization that wants to help us out. But honestly, we're just too fresh right now. We haven't sought out that specific avenue so far.
Are most of your members young like you are?
We have a variety. We have people age 60 to age 18. I mean, it's just, and everything in between.
And how are you getting your word out? I mean, you've got a Facebook page, you've got a web page. How do you you recruit?
Well, right now, well, at least I hope so. But actually, so far, it's mostly been word of mouth. We're hoping to have some ads up in some of the local publications or on Facebook or internet ads, hopefully sometime soon. You know, we hope to just go around the community and see if anyone's interested.
Okay. Sounds great. So where can we find out some more information about when the meetings are, how people can get involved?
Well, our meetings are every second Sunday at 5 p.m. We haven't chosen a permanent location yet, but if anyone is interested, they can go to the website, which I said earlier again is www.republicansforinclusion.com. And you can contact us there, and we can add you to our email list. You can also seek us out on Facebook, and we'll send you that information about our meeting locations then. And otherwise, our email is inclusivegop@aol.com. You're free to email us there.
Okay, Chris Busby is with Republicans for Inclusion, a new group here in Houston. And if you're interested, you can go to the website. You're listening to Queer Voices.
I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
And I'm Rick Watts.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending March 13, 2010. Gay and lesbian couples married for the first time this week in the capital cities of both the U.S. and Mexico, while a federal judge annulled last week's first gay marriage in Argentina's capital city of Buenos Aires. Same-gender couples in Washington, D.C. began tying the knot on March 9th in ceremonies ranging from a D.C. Superior Court chamber to a Unitarian church in the northwest part of the city. Couples can get their licenses 3 business days after applying. March 9th was the first day couples could pick up the licenses and actually marry in the district. Marriage Bureau officials said the 466 applications they received in the week since they were available to same-gender couples is much higher than the usual 50 or so. Mayor Adrian Fenty, who signed the legalization measure in December after its 11-2 passage by the City Council, invoked his parents' interracial marriage as he congratulated the newlyweds at a news conference. The weddings, he said, were a great step forward for equality and for our city that has always been a standard bearer for treating people equally and justly.
Even as the newlyweds celebrated, the Washington Post noted the politics at work in the selection by the Human Rights Campaign of the first couples to wed in front of dozens of TV cameras and reporters. The 3 couples, 2 female and 1 male, were all African American. Peter D. Rosenstein of the local Campaign for All DC Families said it was to counter the misperception voiced by opponents that the fight for marriage equality is really for rich Caucasian men. The Post noted that 27 readers had canceled their subscriptions because it ran a front-page photo of a gay couple kissing outside the Marriage Bureau. But the newspaper strongly stood by its editorial decision. The U.S. Capitol joins the states of Connecticut, Iowa, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, and Vermont to open marriage to lesbian and gay couples. The Clinton-era so-called Defense of Marriage Act, however, forbids the federal government from recognizing any of those marriages. In a related story, the district's Catholic Charities announced on March 1st that it would not offer spousal health insurance to any new employees or current employees who don't already have it. The extraordinary move came just 2 days before same-gender couples started getting marriage licenses in the city. Charities President Edward Orzechowski claimed that it was necessary to remain faithful to the church's teaching.
Gay and lesbian couples began marrying in the capital of heavily Roman Catholic Mexico on March 11th. Mexico City became the first place in Latin America to pass a law explicitly recognizing same-gender marriage in December of last year. It gives same-gender couples the same marriage and adoption rights as heterosexually married couples. Mayor Marcelo Ebrard was a guest of honor at the weddings of 4 same-gender couples on the patio of the old City Hall building. Dozens of reporters served as unofficial witnesses. A 5th couple, flying in from another state to take advantage of the new measure, arrived late, but was quickly married soon thereafter.
Local authorities gave each couple an arrangement of flowers. Mexican law requires recognition of same-gender marriages performed in the capital city in all of the country's 31 states. The Roman Catholic Archdiocese of Mexico issued a statement on the day of the first marriages, accusing the city government of approving a perverse and immoral law. The politically conservative federal government is challenging the legislation in the country's Supreme Court, but justices have not prevented lesbian and gay couples from continuing to marry in Mexico City. "They are not challenging a legislature," said David Razu, who led the marriage equality push there. "They are challenging history, and they will lose."
But last week's first marriage of a gay couple in Argentina's capital of Buenos Aires was annulled this week by federal judge Felix Gustavo de Egarzabal. He ordered Damian Bernath and Jorge Salazar to return any marriage license or documentation they got from the civil registry office or face monetary penalties. The couple married there on March 3rd after a local judge cleared the way. Egarzabal overturned that ruling, arguing that no marriage took place because of the absence of the institution's structural elements, which he said define marriage as exclusively heterosexual. Argentina's lawmakers are currently considering two bills that would legalize marriage equality. The country's Supreme Court is also considering two unrelated same-gender marriage cases. After being denied the right to marry late last year in Buenos Aires, Alex Freire and José María de Bello were wed in Ushuaia, the capital of the province of Tierra del Fuego, after the governor ordered the civil registry office there to perform and register the marriage. Theirs remains the first and now only legal same-gender civil marriage in Argentina.
Back in the U.S., college students in Virginia have been protesting a letter sent last week by Republican State Attorney General Ken Cuccinelli to public universities, telling them to drop sexual orientation from their non-discrimination policies. Cuccinelli said that only lawmakers have the authority to extend those protections. The Republican-led House of Delegates recently defeated the latest attempt to do that. In addition to thousands of students who joined Facebook pages protesting the order, others not on spring break have held rallies and demonstrations on various campuses across the state. Opponents of the move also worry that rescinding the protections, which are in place at all the state's largest schools, could reduce the competitiveness of Virginia's higher education system. Republican Governor Bob McDonnell, who was elected in November on a ticket with Cuccinelli, said he supports the legal reasoning of his attorney general's letter, but claims that he's personally opposed to discrimination. Following sharp criticism after sexual orientation was pointedly omitted in an executive order he issued banning discrimination in state employment, his two Democratic predecessors had included sexual orientation in their orders, McDonnell this week issued a directive claiming to remedy the problem. But critics note that a directive is essentially toothless and has no enforcement provisions.
Meanwhile, Sacred Heart of Jesus Catholic School in Boulder, Colorado, has said two young children are no longer welcome because they have two moms. The Roman Catholic Archdiocese of Denver said in a statement that homosexual couples living together as a couple are in disaccord with Catholic teaching. No person shall be admitted as a student in any Catholic school, the statement said, quoting Archdiocese policy, unless that person and his, her parents subscribe to the school's philosophy and agree to abide by the educational policies and regulations of the school and archdiocese. School officials told the parents that one of the children could complete kindergarten and that the other could complete preschool, but neither could continue after that. Neither the two moms nor their children have been publicly identified. Some anonymous school staff members who said they'd been ordered not to speak with the media told a local TV station they were disheartened to work at a school that preaches love and peace, but makes such a decision. Despite widespread criticism, it's legal for the Archdiocese to deny any student's enrollment in its privately run schools.
And finally, a lesbian high school student in Mississippi caught the media's eye in a big way this week. 18-year-old Constance McMillan wanted to bring her girlfriend to the upcoming prom at the Itawamba County Agricultural High School in Fulton and to wear a tuxedo to the event. The principal told her she couldn't do that. So Constance contacted the American Civil Liberties Union, which filed a lawsuit on her behalf against the school. The school board responded by canceling the prom, making Constance a pariah to some on campus. The board issued a statement blaming distractions to the educational process caused by recent events, but didn't reference McMillan or her girlfriend, who's also a student at the school. But worldwide media reports have generated widespread support for the high school senior. McMillan, whose father strongly backs her, told CBS News that, "I just want to go to the prom and bring my date, just like everyone else gets to." New Orleans hotel owner Sean Cummings said he was so disappointed with the school board's decision that he's offered to transport the students in buses to the city and host a second chance prom free of charge at one of his properties. The Mississippi Safe Schools Coalition says it's raising funds to hold an inclusive prom somewhere else in Fulton. And an ACLU Facebook page for her, Let Constance Take Her Girlfriend to Prom, had almost 155,000 fans as of Saturday morning, March 13th. She posted a brief thank you message there.
Okay, I just want to thank everybody so much for all the support. I appreciate it so much because, I mean, I never thought in a thousand billion years that there would be that many people that were supporting something that I was doing. And I think it's great that there's that many people out there that understand the difference between wrong and right. And I just want to say that I think you should stand up for what you believe in, stand up for who you are. And that's just the message that I'm trying to send people.
Kate Kendall, executive director of the National Center for Lesbian Rights, posted a comment on her own Facebook page. "Things I would never have done in high school," she wrote. "One, try to attend the senior prom with my girlfriend. 2, sue the school's ass when they cancel the prom. Constance is a true shero. Damn, you go, girl."
That's News Wrap for the week ending March 13th, 2010. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. You can read the text of this week's News Wrap online at www.thiswayout.org. For This Way Out, I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
And I'm Rick Watts.
This is Queer Voices. So you're married, or maybe you have a girlfriend, and you chase a little same-sex spare on the side. It's called Being on the Down Low. I'm Glenn Holt, and Summer Iman is here with me in the studio, and joining us also, Tim Jones from the Montrose Counseling Center. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me, Glenn and Summer.
Well, thank you for joining us. We wanted to ask a couple questions about down low culture, such as is this the term that people self-identify, or is this a term that other people use to describe this behavior?
Yes.
I'm sorry. Okay. From my experience, I've never had anyone tell me that they were down low. Mm-hmm. I think it's more of a expression, it's more of a term that other people have used. Now, I've been telling that it started in the gay community, but when it started in the African American community, actually, as like someone trying to be slick or pull the wool over someone's eyes or something. But eventually, a subculture of black gay men or black men who sleep with other men kind of use the term as I would say.
But you're doing fish too.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's actually, you know, they started using a term to identify other guys, other gay men who have sex with men, other men who have sex with men, and they don't identify as gay or bisexual.
Yeah. Why is that?
I think it comes to how people identify themselves. There are a lot of, especially in the African American gay community, that there are a lot of guys who don't consider themselves gay or bisexual, who do have sex with other men. If you run across a straight acting man who has sex with other men, and ask him what his sexuality is, he's more than likely to tell you he's straight.
So, in the description of your job at the beginning of the show mentioned that you were involved in trying to get people to have like less risky behaviors. Is there a risk association there?
Yes, as a community promise specialist at the Montrose Counseling Center, the program I'm in, the intervention that I'm involved with, is actually geared towards African American men, helping them to be able to reduce their risk. It's like they're trying. We're trying to get them to go from one stage of change to another, another way of thinking. In other words, if they're having sex without a condom, okay, then we want them to start at least getting the idea of maybe wanting to use a condom more often to reduce their risk for transmission of HIV.
Community Promise?
Yes, Community Promise. It's an intervention, prevention intervention, where we go out, we do community identification, things like that. Say if it's like in the Montrose area, and we find other men who are like in our target population, which is in mine, once again, is African American gay MSM. And what we do is we have those people go out, they're like the gatekeepers, so per se, of the community. You know, they're the people that people listen to, or they look up to.
You said that you tried to get people to change their attitudes about condom use. Is this something that you see particular to men who have sex with men that are African American, or is this this people who men who have sex with men that don't identify as gay or bisexual in general? I mean, basically, what I'm asking is there more risky behaviors associated with this demographic as opposed to someone who was closeted of another race, or even not necessarily closeted, because that assumes that they are gay or bi, but someone who has sex with men but does not identify?
Here's the deal, okay? HIV is rising. HIV has risen amongst the population that is more at risk for contracting HIV are African American women between the ages of 18 and 35. Okay, and those women are being affected by men who have sex with other men, whether they identify as straight or gay or bisexual. Okay, so. Our thing is we're reaching out to African Americans because I can walk across the street and see a black MSM or African American MSM, and he probably won't tell me that he sleeps with men. So
MSM.
Yeah, men who sleep with men. Yeah, men who have sex with men. And so the thing is that though that particular population, the down low brother, like we like to call, like some people like to call them, those guys. Or they'll have HIV, they'll contract HIV from having unprotected sex with another man, but they won't get tested, okay? And they'll deny that, they'll act as if they don't even have sex with a man.
But, like, someone could get HIV from having sex with a woman, you know, that they weren't being honest about either. I mean, I guess I'm just kind of thinking that, you know, aren't women also at risk from just partners that are having sex, having unprotected sex?
Yes.
You know, regardless of what the other person's preferences with partners is.
Yes, they are. They are at risk. But the thing about it is that a lot of the women who are contracting HIV are contracting from men who have sex with men. And a lot of those men are DL men.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess the message is, girlfriend, you don't know what your man be doing. Be careful.
Well, we never want to say, we never want to just tell them that, because, you know, it's all about trust. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a trust issue when you're having sex with your partners and things like that. What I always tell people when I have run across women who say, well, I want to get tested for HIV because I don't know what my husband, boyfriend, man, partner is doing, then I always tell them, if there's any doubt there, use condoms.
On a slightly different tack, as I stutter on the air, sorry.
That's okay.
People who men who have sex with men, or MSM, mm-hmm. are they more likely to identify as same gender loving, or is that a term that's not very prevalent in Houston, or an identity?
It's it's not a term really prevalent in Houston. You see it more in the media than you do in when you're with people one on one, or you with a group of people. I've never been around guys who identify themselves as down low. I've never had a guy say, when I ask guys about their sexual preferences or what they have to do sexually, I've never had a guy tell me I'm on the down low. I've had some guys tell me they don't have sex with men, and then turn around and do and show behaviors that are associated with being involved with men, but I've never heard the term DL specifically coming from other guys.
Do you think this is partly because of the acceptance or lack of acceptance of alternate sexualities within certain ethnic communities and churches?
Yes, especially in the African-American church. Okay, that is being gay or having sex with men having sex with men is totally frowned upon. It's really not accepted. And yes, that does have something to do with community acceptance, because these are guys who act masculine. These are hard dudes. You know what I'm saying? They want you to look at them as to all men. So if they find, if you find out that they're having sex with another man, that kind of like warps and twists your idea of what they are. And you know, you have some guys who have sex with other men for different reasons. You know, they have sex with men for money. You know, they had sex. I met two guys from out of town last week who have sex with men, and they're married. Okay, and they.
Okay, now they're married to each other or married to women?
They're married to women. Okay, and they, they didn't identify as gay.
But they have sex with other men for money.
No, they have sex with other men because they like having sex with other men.
Okay.
So that's a reason why. But you have some guys who have sex with guys just for the money.
So, what do you think of this kind of? I guess it's just a difference between sexual behavior and identity, that somehow, I guess, what it is to be gay, at least as they perceive it, does not fit them, or it somehow doesn't jibe with their own. Personal self-image?
Yes. They don't see them. They just don't see themselves as gay. I mean, they work out. I mean, they, you know, they...
Lots of gay men work out.
Well, you know, I'm just saying they work out. They're, you know, they're all masculine. They love women. Like you said, they chase fish on the hand. They chase fish on the side. You know, that's their primary thing. They love fish. Okay, so... they love being with women, okay, but they just have this thing with, they like being with men also. I mean, and these are guys, men on the down low are men who, their first sexual preference actually is women.
Okay, and now what about women? Can women be on the down low? Are women on the down low?
You know, I was reading an article the other day that says that at the term down low, as far as like when it's geared towards homosexual behavior, was actually first termed in the 30s for lesbian women.
Also wondering, is there another ethnic group in Houston that is, commonly associated with having much more kind of machismo tendencies? It's the Latin American culture, or the Hispanic culture in Houston. Is there like a down-low correlate among that culture that you know of, or are you specifically just on African American men who have sex with men?
The term has been used for Hispanic people also, but it's more coined for African American men. But it's basically the same. The behavior and the sexual behavior and attitudes is the same across the board, actually.
How do you see this portrayed in popular films and TV series and soap operas and such?
Okay.
And I'm not talking about porn, all right?
are you thinking particularly like Noah's Ark or Punks or something, or what?
Yeah, maybe that sort of thing, yeah.
Yeah.
Down low men are portrayed in media as being aggressive, okay, and aggressive sexually, being aggressive mentally, emotionally, period. Whereas with other races, say for instance, like white people, white guys, white MSM, they are portrayed as more as being tormented by the fact that they are, that they have sexual tendencies towards men, and it's just not accepted, you know, and it's nice, and they've been kind of basically being victimized by the community.
How do African American men that identify as bisexual, how are they affected by this term and this culture? Like, are they perceived as just being on the down low, even if they identify as bisexual, or?
Some men who are really true to themselves and being real with themselves, a lot of them will say, "Okay, well, I am bisexual."
Wouldn't you know?
Okay. Okay.
The one time they get me, I get a chance to get behind the mic, I'm like, okay.
Man, what was I saying now? I just lost track.
Bisexual African American men, how they're affected by the down low term.
Okay. A lot of them don't like the term. I know a lot of bisexual and gay men who hate that term. Okay. And I never understood it. It's a recent phenomenon. This stuff has been going on for years, since biblical times. You know, men have been having sex with men since biblical times. So, I think it's more a thing with women, you know, because after the term down low came out, women started paying more attention to how men act, and they start paying more attention to men's sexual behaviors and things like that. I mean, I always tell my friends, especially my girlfriends, I'd be like, "Man, why are y'all just tripping about that? Because this has been going on for years. Okay, it doesn't mean your man's having sex with another man, but you know, this has been going on for a long time."
Right, and there's no way that you can tell from the man's behavior.
There's no way you can tell. I mean, because if a man's going to cheat, he's going to act the same way whether he's cheating with a man or a woman.
Do people who are on the down low, or who, I guess, is it on the down low, or what? How do you?
On the down low.
Okay. that's how the adjective works. Do they pursue people who identify as gay, or do they also pursue people who identify as on the down low? I guess it's, I mean, is it more that way, they keep it more secret that way, or?
Men have sex with men. Men on the down low prefer to be with men who act masculine, cause, you know, men they can bring around their friends and family and things like that. Okay, men who are a little bit more open with their sexuality, they don't have a problem with other men who are, like we like to call it, like, term we like to use, Nelly,
mm-hmm.
or anything like that. You know, they don't have a problem with that. But men who are down low actually prefer to be with other men. And when you go to like certain websites, like Adam for Adam or Manhunt or something like that, a lot of times they'll tell you, you know, they want somebody masculine.
Mm-hmm. Or they'll put DL in their profile.
Mm-hmm. Well, right. Sometimes, yeah, some men will, yeah.
Now, that's going to make your job kind of hard, because you're, for the Montrose Counseling Center, you're trying to do outreach to these people, and by definition, they're being secretive.
Right. So a lot of times, I don't just ask them, "Are you gay, or do you have sex with men?" Sometimes I want to.
Just walk up to people in the hall and say, "Hey."
No, but we, but like when I do HIV tests, and that's one of the things we do, I do ask them if they have sex with a man.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And, but I tend to tell them, I tend to treat a lot of times these guys will, they'll sit there and tell me they're not gay, but then they'll turn around and do something.
It's okay. Don't worry about it.
Oh, okay. They'll turn around and do something that's not, you know, I mean, that's gay related. They'll come on to me, or they'll come on to somebody that I know or something like that. So I just tend to just go ahead and just pass the condoms out and tell them, "Hey, well, give me a call sometimes."
Tim Jones from the Montrose Counseling Center. You know, there's one last question I have to ask you, don't you?
What's that?
Are you on the down low?
What do you think?
You're on a show called Queer Voices. You're doing a damn poor job of it.
Say, I try.
Have you ever been?
Well, I've been closeted, yeah. But yeah, I guess you could say I've been down, like, I've been in gay.
Would you identify closeted as being different than being on the down low?
Personally, I think it's the same thing, because you don't want anybody to know what your sexuality is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't want anybody to know that you have sex with men. You don't want anybody to know that you're attracted to men. So it's the same thing basically to me.
Okay. Tim Jones from the Montrose Counseling Center, thank you so much for coming out and talking about this difficult subject.
Very difficult. Thank you very much for having
me. Thank you.
And Summer Iman, Glenn Holt, Queer Voices.
My boyfriend's always had a girlfriend. There was never any secret to me. No. While he was busy slipping, sliding on the down low, I was just loud and free. I could be. There were even times when I hung out with my man and his lady. And I know that sounds shady. I can't help it if she was too blind to see the signs of another
face. What's going on?
Underneath the nose.
But I'm the one who made any kind of commitment between me and the woman's not my wife. She is. He's the one who made the vow to always be true. Don't get upset with me. My fears where he chose to be. My boyfriend. Girlfriend, I bet you have to have a girlfriend. Perhaps a lady belongs to you. I could be, but I'm not gonna tell you that. I'm not gonna tell you that. Although you really need to consider the fact that sometimes that's the way things be. Your man could be keeping a secret. Never lies, never takes over. As you make a love another man over there, somewhere on the other side. Girl, I know these things are true. Find out 3 years where your husband's been his night, right here, sleeping next to me. You see, I was the one who had him first. So many tears I cried, and I was so in love, couldn't help myself. Cause the pain cut so deep when I overheard the conversation he was having with you one day. Wasn't you and him, but he was my boy, yeah, my boy, yeah, my boy. My heart's too dead. Yeah,
my
oh, my boy,
my friends,
boy,
my boy, yeah. Friends. Always had girlfriends,
always had girlfriends,
always had girlfriends.
Brian K. Washington, my boyfriends have always had girlfriends. At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. Now, more of Queer Voices with Jack Walensky and the entire Queer Voices crew.
Hey! Sing if you're glad to be gay. Just sing if you're happy. This way.
Join the Houston Peace and Justice Center and the Service Employees International Union on Tuesday, March 23rd, for the screening of the film, Bread and Roses at Cafe Brazil at 7 p.m. Bread and Roses deals with the struggle of poorly paid janitorial workers in Los Angeles and their fight for better working conditions, as well as the right to unionize. It is based on the Justice for Janitors campaign of the Service Employees International Union. The film derives its name from the 1912 textile strike in Lawrence, Massachusetts, which united dozens of immigrant communities, a strike largely led by women. Cafe Brazil is located on the corner of Westheimer and Dunleavy Street between Montrose and Shepherd. For more information, visit hpjc.org. This is KPFT Houston. The Alliance for Multicultural Community Services will be hosting their annual Stars Among Us Gala, April 3rd, honoring immigrants who have made significant contributions to improve the quality of life of people around them. This year, the Alliance will honor Dr. Nidil Najam, a Pakistani immigrant and Nobel Prize laureate, for his work on climate change, and Mr. Ahmad Al-Yassin of Jordan, a leader in Houston's Arab American community. Proceeds from the Stars Among Us event fund scholarships for refugee youth resettled by the agency. Individual tickets are $100, or a group can sponsor a table. For more information and to buy tickets, go to www.allianceontheweb.org and click Stars Among Us. This is KPFT Houston.
We've been at war with Iraq since 1990.
Saturday, March 20th, will be the 7th anniversary of the second war in Iraq, which has claimed the lives of hundreds of thousands of people. The war in Afghanistan, which has killed thousands more, will mark its 9th anniversary in the fall. On Saturday, March 20th, you can add your voice to the many across America demanding an end to these wars and funding for jobs, housing, and health care at home. Everyone is invited to a rally against the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan at 2 p.m. in Mason Park, South 75th Street and Tips Street in Houston. For more information, please call 832-692-2306 or 281-93-9248.
We've been at war with Iraq for 20 years.
I am the mother of Matthew Shepherd. He was my son, my friend, my confidant, my constant reminder of how good life can be. He was murdered in October 1998 because he was gay. And there was just something about him that just made people want to talk to him, want to share, want to be his friend. You measure a person's success by the friends they leave behind. And I think that was a great success.
Seen him playing in his backyard. Young boy, just starting out. So much history in this landscape. So much confusion, so much doubt. Been there drinking on that front porch. Angry kids, mean and dumb. Looks like a painting, that blue skyline. God hates facts, where we come from. Western sky, don't make it right. Down the deep. dream. But it's your blood that stains their hands. Western skies don't make a rise. Home of the brave don't make no sense. I seen the scarecrow wrapped in a wire, left to die on a high ridge fence. It's a cold, cold wind. It's a cold, cold wind. It's a cold wind blow. Wyoming.
That's a song by Elton John, actually a memorial for Matthew Shepard, with an opening by Judy Shepard, his mother. Now, on a brighter note, out to what would normally be the snowy fields of Iowa, but Joan Devlin is in Portland this evening? Joan?
Yes, I'm in Portland, Oregon for work, so I need to call you guys a little bit earlier than usual.
Yeah, so you're out in Portland. Wow. Well, how's the weather out in Portland?
It's warm and sunny and spring-like. It's very nice.
Wonderful. We have somebody sitting here in the studio all by themselves ready to talk to you.
Great.
So go ahead and introduce yourselves.
Hi there.
Hi. I'm talking to Micaiah Hart, who is the author of My Sweet Wild Dance, among other things that she's done. If you go on her website, she has many, many interesting stories about things like kite surfing, and also the time she acted as a crossing guard for a tarantula. So, Micaiah, welcome to KPFT.
Thank you very much for having me on the show. I appreciate it.
Can you tell us a little bit about your book, which is up for a couple of awards right now?
Mm-hmm. Well, this book is my own personal story of my journey from anger to joy. And I had a pretty messed up childhood, and I had a lot of reasons to be angry. I mean, I say that, and that is true of my life, but I also think in this world it's very easy to spend a lot of time being angry, because you look around you and you see a lot of things that are wrong. And in reality, it doesn't really help anyone if you spend a lot of time being angry about all those things. It's really a lot better for the world and for everyone in it if you can be in a place of joy. So My Sweet Wild Dance is about how I learned to dance my own sweet wild dance, and it's sweet and wild because it's mine and it's joyful.
So give us a little bit of background, because you've written several books, but mm-hmm. that's not, well, really, you don't like labels, but so you're not just an author, you're a life coach, you do all kinds mm-hmm. of things. Give our audience a little background on yourself, please.
Mm-hmm. Well, I grew up in Scotland. Actually, my parents were sort of a declining upper-class family. And that was in the 50s and 60s, and post-war Scotland, and there was a great deal of alcoholism and denial and depression. So I was abused. I was molested by a number of different men before I was 7 years old. And I forgot about those as I grew up, of course, because it was very unacceptable to have any kind of negative emotion, especially if you're a woman. You know, you're just supposed to get married and have kids. That's what women are for. And I just couldn't quite fit in that box. I never managed to fit in any box very well. So as I got older, I became very politically active and went to a fairly radical university and lived in a commune. And then I came out as a lesbian and a feminist, and I was involved in all kinds of what would probably be called terrorist activities these days, actually. The kind of sexism that I was dealing, well, that we were dealing with in the 70s was pretty amazing. And there was a guy, I was living in Leeds in the north of England, and there was a guy, a serial rapist who'd been on the loose for some years, and the police, they had no idea, you know, they had no leads on him at all. And their main tack was telling women that they should stay home at night. So a whole group of us got together, and we did a lot of actions, and our slogan was "Curfew on Men," which was so appropriate, you know, that it shouldn't be women who are being punished for being the victims, and that's still very true these days. Anyway, I came out as a lesbian then, and those were pretty hard times, and I moved to Northern California when I was 30. It was 1982. I'd heard that there were 20,000 lesbians in the Bay Area, and I reckon that was a very good reason for going there. So I lived in Northern California. I actually moved out into the boonies. I've always felt very, very comfortable out in nature. I'm not a city girl at all. And I built my own house out of recycled wood, and I raised organic hogs and sold to the best restaurants in the San Francisco Bay Area and raised organic vegetables. And I also in that time did a tremendous amount of healing work. And it was really out of that work that the book My Sweet Wild Dance arose. It's very hard really to describe in brief the work I was doing, but it was around my sexuality and around the molest issues. I actually did some shamanic training in the mid-80s with a local woman, and that was incredibly helpful. It was a wonderful way to get in touch with my own inner wisdom. And that has never failed me. That's really stood by me ever since.
I wanted to... You mentioned the 70s and the 80s. Mm-hmm. How have you seen the movement evolve over time, and where do you see it going? What would you tell, you know, maybe young women coming out today?
Well, things are... Well, actually, in some parts of the world, they're not so very different. But in the West... it's actually very amazing to me and wonderful to me to see how the young women who are growing up are so much more in their power. Now, of course, that isn't true of all young women growing up, but there are far more young women who are in their power than there were when I was, in my early 20s. And it's very, very delightful to see these women being willing to be who they are in the world without any kind of apology at all. It's really great. And, you know, you look at reality, and there's, still very much men are in charge. And there's still a long way to go to balance the masculine and the feminine. And, you know, more than anything, I feel at this point in time, men have really got to start taking responsibility for changing. And I don't mean that men are the problem. I used to think men were the problem, and then I realized, no, it's not that there's any one set of people who are the problem. It's just that, you know, the world is in a process of evolution, and we want that evolution to hurry up a little in certain areas. And, you have to be, in the end, we all have to be really honest with ourselves and really willing to step out and tell the truth and be who we are in the world. And, you know, step out of these boxes that everybody's got prepared for us. And that takes a lot of courage.
And that brings me back to your book, because I wanted you to talk a little bit about the awards your book is up for. I normally ask people what the response has been, but since you're up for a couple of awards here, perhaps you can tell us in more detail what the response has been around those awards.
Well, the Lambda Literary Award, I mean, there are a number of Lambda Literary Awards, and mine is in the lesbian memoir section. I think it has a pretty good chance of winning, but I really don't know, because it's so hard for me to read my own books, to read any book. And I can only judge it from my own viewpoint, and I've learnt over the years that I have pretty non-traditional viewpoints, and so my ideas are they're likely to be different from other people's. And that's the thing with an award. It really depends on whoever's judging it. It really depends whether they like your lifestyle. I mean, your writing style. My book is about my lifestyle, and it might also be, you know, it might be that people would not be so sure that that they... Yeah,
well,
maybe.
I was afraid that was going to happen. Joan kind of dropped off, but we're going to get her back. So,
all right.
Yeah, those things happen when you have cell phones and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But while we're waiting for getting Joan back on the line, give us again the name of the book.
It's called My Sweet Wild Dance.
Okay. And you wrote it because?
Well, it's my life story. It was really a healing for me to write it. It was an amazingly cathartic process for me to write it.
Good,
it was
good.
Wonderful.
Well, Joan is back with us, and Joan, I just asked why the book was written, so you can take it from there.
Mm-hmm.
Joan?
Yeah,
Joan?
Well, I think, was the book, when you wrote it, was it like a cathartic experience for you, or were you just one of these people who always felt like you had a book in you and it just had to come out?
Oh, I'm writing for me is, I hear about other people having writer's block, and sometimes I'm almost envious of that. What happens for me is when something wants to be written, it's not even really anything to do with me. An idea starts germinating in my head, and the next thing I know, the words are just pouring out of me, and if I try to ignore them, they keep me awake at night. I have to write them. And this book was a little different because it was really about me dealing with a lot of a big emotional backlog as I was writing it. So it was a very long time in the writing. And the book originally was much longer than it is now. And I mainly cut it to make it, to try and make it appeal to a wider audience, which actually, strangely enough, I mean, I'm kind of surprised that the kind of people who've read it and said to me, this book really spoke to me, people who are very, very different from me have said that, and that's very pleasing, you know.
Now, how can people get a copy of the book, My Sweet Wild Dance?
You should be able to order it from any bookstore, certainly from Amazon. I'm doing a reading here in Houston on Thursday evening at the main library. It's I believe it's the Readers Series, the GLBTQ Readers Series that are putting it on. Anyway, I think that's at 6:30 at the main library. So if anybody wants to come and hear me talking about it at the library and ask me questions, they're more than welcome. And I'll have books for sale there, too.
Great. Well, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to come to KPFT tonight. We've been speaking to Micaiah Hart, author of My Sweet Wild Dance. She will be appearing at the main library.
Yes.
At about 6:30 on the 18th of this month, which is in 3 days. Please try to catch her. I'm sure she's as wonderful in person as she's been to us on the phone tonight.
Well, thank you so much, Joan. It's really a pleasure to be here and to speak with you.
Thank you. And you're listening to KPFT 90.1 FM Houston.
As you swim.
local artist by the name of Mike Trevino. He's actually from San Antonio, and that's from a CD single, a private label release from 2009, and the name of the song, One Night Fling. This is Queer Voices.
Well, we've got a very serious issue to talk about now. Eric Rowland from Legacy Health Services is with us again, and he's going to talk to us about HIV and syphilis rates among gay and bisexual men. Now, is this new information, or is this worse information, or what?
That's an excellent way to start that out. It is somewhat new information. It is really a new way of looking at the information. For years, we've always had rates of HIV infection in African American women, or rates of infection in heterosexual white women, but we've never had a rate of infection for gay and bisexual men.
Really? Why is that?
Because we don't have a denominator.
Okay.
We don't know how many gay men there are living in the United States. And in order for you to have a rate, then you, per 100,000 population, you have to have a population. Well, our census doesn't track sexual orientation.
Exactly, exactly. And people who are HIV, the records don't necessarily show that they're gay, right?
Correct. There is a, whenever someone is diagnosed as HIV positive, they get put into a category. If they say that they know they got HIV from another man, they go in the what's called the MSM category, men who have sex with men. But if they say they don't know how they got HIV, and that might be because they know how, but they just don't want to tell
right.
the health department employee sitting in front of them asking the questions, if they don't know how they got HIV, they go into an undetermined box.
Okay.
And that undetermined piece of the pie is actually fairly large.
I'm not surprised.
But it changes over time, because what we found is that men and women both start to feel comfortable with their doctor, and then they start to go, "Doc, you know, I know how I got it. I got it from injection drug use, but I never wanted to tell, you know, that health department." Or a guy who says, "I know I got it from men."
Is that data then updated?
That data is updated.
But yes. Is it confidential?
It is. Okay. All of that whole system is extremely confidential. In fact, the only name-based data is kept at the local health department, and here in Texas, the state health department, but it is de-identified before it ever goes to the federal level.
And we've never had a problem with that,
nope,
have we?
Never had a breach of confidentiality in the state of Texas. There have been a couple other states where there's been minor problems, but none in Texas.
So I guess you probably had a guess on this, that syphilis rates were higher. I mean, working in Legacy.
Yes, yes. The syphilis rates have been higher since about 2001 is when they first started to come back among that gay and bisexual male population. Prior to that, we really rarely saw syphilis in gay and bisexual men.
And is there any clue of why that's happening?
You know, I think it's kind of a clue to the overall picture of HIV and syphilis in gay and bisexual men, and it's the complacency issue. It's the HIV medications. People think that, well, that'll make you live longer, and it's okay if you get HIV. By the way, it's not okay if you get HIV. Mm. It's a difficult road still in this day and age. I think it's those types of issues, complacency, difficulty in practicing safer sex 100% of the time for an entire lifetime.
Well, wow. The drugs have been incredible. But now that the drugs have been out so many years, are we starting to see some side effects, or that they're not working?
You know what? They always seem to be on top of those side effects. You know, just the other day, I heard that they're going to start to not recommend some of the medications that came out in the early 90s right. or the late 90s even, because they are associated with side effects. And now they've got these new drugs that have been studied to not produce the same side effects. So it seems like they're always on top of side effects, but there are always some side effects.
And of course you have to have access to the drugs.
Exactly. Yeah. Right.
And you have to use them very strictly.
Exactly. Yes.
What about resistance? Some of the new earlier drugs, HIV virus has developed resistance. Some of the earlier drugs don't work anymore.
Correct. That's very true. Sometimes they've found that they work in different dosages. And some of them, and it depends on people. We know a lot of people out there who are resistant to, let's say, the original drug, AZT. But yet there's a large percentage of people who that drug works on them. So it really depends on the virus and what's going on in your body.
Mm. So what do we do about syphilis? How do we...
Well, I think one of the issues with syphilis is we've really got to educate the population. It can be transmitted in ways that we've come to know HIV is really not that big of an issue. We've all come to know that HIV is not as predominantly transmitted through oral sex. It's mainly transmitted through anal sex. Syphilis, very easily transmitted through oral sex. And people just don't know the symptoms as well as they know HIV, and they're not as concerned about it. It's not on their radar as much.
And what are the symptoms?
The symptoms. First set of symptoms comes about 2 weeks after, 10 days to 2 weeks after exposure, and it's an open, painless sore. Could be the size of a pimple, could be the size of a dime. And depends on where it is, whether you notice it. If it's in a visible place on your genitals, you're probably going to notice it and go, ooh, I need to go do something about this. But again, if you've had oral sex and you have this open, painless sore in your mouth, you're probably never going to know it's there. And it goes away on its own without any kind of treatment, without any intervention, but you still have syphilis. And about 6 weeks later, the second set of symptoms comes in, and that's usually a rash, and that rash is usually on the palms of the hand or the bottom of the feet. But that can also be associated with fevers, hair loss. Guys, if you're 25 years old and your hair is falling out, go see the doctor. It's very likely you may have syphilis. Because it's not likely that people's hair falls out in chunks at, 20, 25, 30 years old.
And what do we do about it?
Syphilis is completely curable. Penicillin. It's a series of injections of penicillin, completely curable. However, that doesn't mean that you're immune to it in the future. It's curable at that point. You can get infected again.
Now that we've been with HIV and AIDS for many years, what's happening in that? Are people a little bit more comfortable about finding out about it? I mean, and especially people who may not be as comfortable about being gay or may not be gay.
Mm-hmm. I think that it really varies by community. There are still certain areas that are just getting to a test and getting tested and finding out, even if you know you're at risk, can be very difficult. Think about the rural areas where, not all gay men live in the cities. They also live in the rural areas, and getting tested out in the rural areas may be very difficult. They'd either have to drive to a city or take the risk of going to their local doctor, and they're scared that, so-and-so came in here and got HIV tested. Even though it's against the law to tell that information, people still have that fear.
And the doctors may not even be prepared.
Correct. The doctors may not be prepared. One of the ways I think we're trying to combat that is to really look at and promote opt-out testing. Testing that happens whenever you go to the doctor's office. You go to the doctor's office, you get your cholesterol done, you get your blood counts done, they look at your white blood cell count, they take your blood pressure. Why not add on that extra HIV test? So there's a really big push right now. Legacy is involved in a study and a pilot project to look at testing in a universal setting. And so we're doing that at two of our clinics, everybody who comes in to get their blood drawn. Now, they can opt out. They can say, no, I don't want to get tested right now. And that's fine. But we really encourage them to get tested.
And I know we're dealing with confidentiality, but can you even talk about that? Or is that too early to talk about that some people are finding out that probably didn't have a clue that they could have been positive?
Sure. I mean, we still get people in who have absolutely no idea that they're positive. And I think you really find that in the African-American community, where oftentimes they might not seek health care out right away. And we often see the people in the African-American community are getting diagnosed with HIV and AIDS at the same time because they've ignored it.
Right.
Or they've never thought about being at risk, so they don't go get tested. And I think that's another way that opt-out testing can really catch some of those people who may be using a public clinic once a year to get a physical, or going to the emergency room, where it's also a really good idea to do this opt-out testing.
I hear this finally talking about gay men have been pretty much told not to give blood, and it's still, they don't want blood from gay men, but there's sort of this movement now to say that people who are gay men who are not HIV positive, why they still should be banned from giving blood.
Yeah, well, let's first of all state that it is still banned. Gay men are still banned from donating blood. I find so many people that have no idea about that, and they're like, and even gay men who said, oh, I didn't know that. And I'm like, yeah, you can't give blood. If you say on the questionnaire that you're a man and you've had sex with other men, you're banned from giving blood. And it comes from the early 80s, when we had a great big scare in the blood supply, and most of the cases of HIV were in gay men. So at the time, it made sense.
Right,
okay, let's watch this. We don't need to take blood. But they test the blood supply. Everybody who comes in to donate blood, I don't care who you are, your blood is tested for HIV. So the ban seems to be a little unnecessary. And it also is discriminatory, because gay men are not the only ones who get HIV.
Right, right. And there is a definite need for blood.
Sure, for sure.
Well, there's a larger and larger segment of the population who are quote-unquote straight because they've been infected, like we were saying, in the black community, the
Correct.
Women in the black community, and they may or may not know until they go, you know, to T-test it. So that really doesn't work. That's really not, that's 1980s.
It is.
That's
it is
30 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to use the logic that there's more gay men with HIV than other populations, then we look at the statistics among African Americans, and if you look at those, then logic would say that African Americans should be banned from donating blood.
Mm.
But that would be ridiculous
right,
to say that.
Right. Legacy's come a long way since the early days of the Montrose Clinic to be basically just giving STD tests.
Correct.
And right now you're basically a provider of health services, right?
General primary health care, yes. I mean, we still have that big focus on HIV, that big specialty in HIV and STDs. But yeah, now we offer primary health care services to anybody.
And it's on a sliding scale?
It is on a sliding scale. We do accept health insurance policies, quite a few, most health insurance, and we also do Medicaid and Medicare. But for any of those folks out there, and I know there are lots of folks out there without health insurance, they may have a job, but their job may not offer them health insurance, and it's too expensive to afford on their own, or they may just not make enough money to even apply or to go get health care anywhere. They can come to us, and it's on a sliding scale.
And what about somebody who has health insurance, but the deductibles are so high? Is there a way for help on that?
There is. It kind of depends on what's going on, but we can certainly work with them. Sometimes it might be, we would certainly encourage that person to go back to their open enrollment the next time around and go, hey, I got to change this because I made the wrong choice in the plan. A lot of people take, oh, I'm going to take the cheapest way because my paycheck's not as,
right.
doesn't go as
right.
far anymore, and let me take the cheapest health insurance plan possible. And then they realize that when they might have to go on a medication or they might have some sort of health complication, oh, that was the wrong plan to pick.
Well, you also have a pharmacy at Legacy.
That's true. We're true. We have a Walgreens pharmacy inside our 215 Westheimer location. And so it makes it easy on people to get medications. And the other thing, as a community health center, we're able to get a discount on prescriptions, and then we can pass that discount on to the patient.
That's great, because I was hearing that people that have insurance, their insurance have already negotiated those lower prices, but when you don't have insurance, you end up paying more. But you all try to work with that.
Yes, yes, for sure. And we get discounted rates, so we pass that on to the consumer.
So how does a person get services from Legacy?
They can just call our general number, 713-830-3000, or visit our website, legacycommunityhealth.org. And if you call, Say what you're interested in seeing. You want to become a new patient? Are you concerned about diabetes? Let us know, you know, what type of illness you have, if anything, and let us know you need primary health care, and we'll get you set up for appointments.
And what are your hours?
Our hours currently are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 7 p.m., and Fridays, 9 to 5.
So you have after sort of work hours.
We do have some after work hours, and hopefully in the future we will be offering after hours and possibly weekend hours.
Wow.
We're really looking at doing that because we know a lot of people work long hours and they can't get up here to get in to see the doctor. So we do want to look at expanded hours in the future.
Great. Eric Rowland is with Legacy Health Services, and the best way to get some more information is to call?
Is to call 713-830-3000 or visit our website at legacycommunityhealth.org.
You're listening to Queer Voices.
Up next, a salute to a standout soldier and those who march in his footsteps. Then later in the program, South Africa's queer positive constitution gives little consolation to a lesbian survivor of corrective rape.
Leonard Matlevich, decorated soldier, coming up now on The Rainbow Minute. Leonard Matlevich was born in 1943. After high school, he enlisted in the Air Force, requesting service in Vietnam. He survived three tours of duty, earning a Purple Heart and a Bronze Star for his meritorious service. He continued in the service as a race relations instructor. In 1975, following his own lessons on equality and social acceptance, he came out to his commander and was promptly discharged. His story made national news. He took his case to court, and in 1980, a federal judge ordered Matlevich reinstated into the Air Force with back pay. Upon his death in 1988, he was interred in Washington, D.C. with full military honors and a 21-gun salute. On his headstone were the words he himself had spoken: "When I was in the military, they gave me a medal for killing two men and a discharge for loving one." The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded in the studios at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Shay White.
That was Matt Alber and Tom Goss singing Who We Are. The duo says they wrote the song especially for the strong men and women who carry the wounded on their shoulders and the added burden of a nation's bigotry on their backs. You can find more about this musical protest of Don't Ask, Don't Tell online at popularpublicity.com.
You're listening to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine brought to you by you. Your charitable donations keep this program on the air. We've produced some special CDs, say thank you to our supporters, featuring queer history, reviews of LGBT music, and behind-the-scenes looks at relevant movies and TV shows. You can also now get CDs of our regular program by subscription, and be sure you never miss a week of This Way Out. For all the details, please visit our website at thiswayout.org. Again, to find out more, please do log on to thiswayout.org, email tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA.
Archbishop Desmond Tutu this week denounced what he called a wave of hate spreading across the African continent. The Nobel Peace Prize winner penned a ringing op-ed column in the Washington Post enumerating recent attacks on the rights of LGBT people in Senegal, Malawi, Kenya, and other countries. Tutu pointed the finger at politicians he said were looking for scapegoats for their failures. He also called on his fellow clerics of all faiths to stand up for the principles of universal dignity and fellowship. No doubt Tutu's impassioned words were inspired in part by the rising tide of homophobic violence in his own South Africa. That's the country in the spotlight in the conclusion of our Radio Netherlands-produced series about gays and lesbians in Africa. Jonathan Gruber continues his conversation with Scott Long of Human Rights Watch and Namibian-born South African gay activist Ian Swartz.
Ian, you live in South Africa now. Can you be out there?
Yes, I can have a very out life and live a very open life with a partner and, you know, share a house and do all of that. But I realize that despite the South African constitution being one of the best in the world when it comes to the protection of gay and lesbian people, that that is not necessarily the story of every South African.
There is a very ugly anti-gay sentiment in the country as well.
I don't think, you know, that we can be too complacent and think that this, you know, this is the struggle that we've won, because it's in no way over.
Well, let me introduce a new topic here, and this is something that is happening a lot in South Africa as well, and it has to do with lesbians and something called corrective rape. Now, this is a phenomenon in which lesbians are being deliberately targeted because it's thought that forced heterosexual intercourse will make them straight. And I have a clip for you taken from the Guardian newspaper's website. It's part of an interview with a young man in one of the South African townships.
If there's someone who is trying to rape those lesbians, me, I can appreciate the thing. That is true. Because we just to let them know they must be in a straight motion of way. I mean, I have no time to rape them, but if there is some of the other guys who wanted to teach them the way, they must rape them, they must rob them. Once she gets raped with the guy, I think she wanna know a way and to do something which is nice. I don't like them.
Gentlemen, do you know people who have been victims of quote-unquote corrective rape?
Absolutely. I was in a township outside Johannesburg at the beginning of this year, where a lesbian, a very well-known popular soccer player, had been raped and murdered by a gang of men, apparently because they didn't like the way she looked. They didn't like the way she dressed. They thought she was too manly. And I spoke to, you know, over a dozen lesbians there who talked about, on the one hand, having this really vibrant community of women in the township, and who also talked about being terrified to walk or to look in a certain way on the streets. Of course, there's a massive rape crisis across South Africa, and in one way or another, all women are in danger. But it's also very clear that despite these wonderful paper promises in the South African Constitution, the government has not promoted the Equality Clause and non-discrimination based on sexual orientation affirmatively in the townships or the rural areas, and that poverty is creating violence, and that lesbian and bisexual women are the victims.
And we're going to hear from one of those survivors right now.
My real name is Mapaseka, but people used to call Steve.
Steve, at an early age, was living an openly gay life. Things were going well with her family. She loved football or soccer. And then one day, when she was 15, a family friend came to the house to sell her some football boots.
I told him to go because there's no one here. He said, no, I'll wait a little bit. And then, that's when the whole thing started. He just mentioned time and time again that you deserve men, and I'm going to show you how a woman, African woman, should be like, you know, and said, why do you enjoy sleeping with women, or why do you enjoy kissing women whatsoever that had to do with lesbian? Or, like, you deserve a guy who's going to lead you, who's going to show you whatever, yeah. So, yeah, he raped me in my own place. Afterwards, he promised to kill me if I say a word.
Steve told her aunt what had happened. The police became involved, and the family friend that raped her was arrested and charged.
The case took 3 years to finish, up until he was sentenced to 26 years in jail. I didn't attend any of this court session because of the trauma that I had to go through. It was my grandmother and my aunt who had to attend that court case. And the last day when he was sentenced, they called me and said, you won't see his face anymore, you won't even hear him around. And I had to, like, be relieved at that moment, and I said, okay, fine, he's gone. He's out of my way. And it left me with scars.
Steve went through many years of counseling, but she's never been able to forget what happened to her at the hands of a family friend.
Sometimes, well, it's even worse now with a lot of hate crimes that are going on in South Africa. One tends to worry, you go back, you reflect, and you've got a lot of rape cases, killing matters and all that. You reflect and you wonder how safe are you if there's a lot of killings like now currently. What might happen next? So you're just not safe in a country or community that you live in. We've got a very glamorous, beautiful constitution, but personally, it's not working for me. We're not implementing what is written there. The justice system, the media people are just failing us. So I just get some time. You're even angry to live in South Africa. You can't live anywhere in African region. I'm scared. I don't want to live in any other countries in Africa. South Africa is better than living in Malawi, for instance, Zimbabwe, for instance. I wouldn't want to live there. But yeah, at this moment, got no choice, have to stay in South Africa.
Steve in South Africa. Ian, Steve mentioned there that South Africa does have a very liberal constitution that protects homosexuals, but yet it doesn't seem to be working for her, so why not?
Jonathan, I think, like in many other settings, progressive constitutions and laws often do not work for the most vulnerable in society. And in South Africa, I think it's the story of many poor South Africans where they feel that this wonderful constitution that we have simply does not protect them in the same way. If you don't have the money to access great lawyers who can then access the courts, etc., you are simply vulnerable. And often the violence that you have and the day-to-day experiences that you have that actually the police should be protecting you from, that goes unreported and unnoticed. And I'm afraid that Steve, who is a very dear person, who I know personally, is just one of many people who experience it that way in South Africa.
Well, Scott, you actually work to protect people like Steve. But
we try.
But what do you do, though, when there's a real disconnect between what's on paper, what's in the law, and the way people treat each other in real life? They're completely disconnected.
It's one of the hardest problems we face in human rights because, you know, what we try to do is to affect practices but not sentiments. However, you know, the struggle for LGBT rights, and this is true globally, not just in Africa, really is a struggle for hearts and minds. The prejudices are deep, the hatred is being fostered actively, and just changing laws we know is not enough. We have to get at the structures of feeling that support the violence. It's also true, though, that law provides a pattern for how people ideally are supposed to live. And this is particularly true of South Africa, which for most of its citizens was a lawless state under apartheid, and where the promise of the Constitution was creating a new model for society that was inclusive, not divisive, where the divisions of race and gender and sexual orientation would be cast aside. And I think we have to both craft a message to South African politicians, you know, that get off your seats and do something about this. Make the Constitution real, but also craft a message to the whole society, which is you passed this Constitution. You passed it because the values in it meant something. And those values have to infuse the way you do behave to each other, the way you treat women and men with respect or with hatred.
Scott Long in New York City and Ian Swartz in South Africa, thank you so much to the both of you for speaking with us.
Thank you, Jonathan, and thank you, Ian, for all the work you do.
Yeah, thank you, Scott, and thanks, Jonathan. This is great.
Scott Long is the director of the LGBT rights program at Human Rights Watch, and Ian Swartz is a gay activist living in South Africa. Our thanks to host Jonathan Gruber and Radio Netherlands for sharing their exploration of gay and lesbian life and lives in Africa. Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. This week, Tanya Kane Perry, Rick Watts, Judd Proctor, and Brian Burns with Jay White and Lucia Chappelle contributed program material. Thanks also to Jonathan Gruber and Eric Beauchemin at Radio Netherlands and to J.D. Doyle. Sweet Honey in the Rock and Tom Goss and Matt Alber performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out is only made possible by our listeners. Thank you. Log on to thiswayout.org to see how you can support our work, listen to our podcasts, read the text of this week's news wrap, or subscribe to CDs of our programs. To receive our weekly program email alert, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappelle and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. We thank you for listening on KEUL Girdwood and Hope, Alaska, 2BAY Byron Bay, New South Wales, WVEW Brattleboro, Vermont, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
This Way Out is heard every week as part of Queer Voices. You are listening to 90.1 FM KPFT. You have been listening to Queer Voices, heard each Monday at 9 p.m. here on KPFT, a publicly funded Pacifica Network station. Queer Voices is produced live in Houston with recorded segments from This Way Out, which is produced at KPFK in Los Angeles, and J.D. Doyle's Queer Music Heritage, which is produced in Houston. Queer Voices executive producer is Jack Valensky. On-air voices are Brian Levinka, Jennifer Renee, J.D. Doyle, Glenn Holt, Summer Iman, and Jack Valensky. For more information about tonight's program, including links to websites and organizations mentioned during the show, visit queervoices.org. And you can send email to jack@queervoices.org. Be sure to listen to KPFT every Sunday morning, starting at 1 a.m. for After Hours with Jimmy Carper. It's Queer Radio with Attitude. At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston, a Pacifica Foundation station. For Queer Voices, I'm Glenn Holt.
Invited to Bluegrass by the Tracks at the Houston Railroad Museum on Saturday, April 10th from noon to 6. Yes, Houston does have a railroad museum with a fine collection of vintage rail equipment in a wooded setting in Northeast Houston. And on April 10th, the Lone Star Bluegrass Band, Digger Davis, Tombstone, and other musical groups will entertain all afternoon to benefit the museum. There will be food, fun, museum tours, and toys for the kids. And a rail fair with a model railroad flea market. Old trains, bluegrass music. It doesn't get any better than that. Saturday, April 10th, noon to 6 p.m. at the Houston Railroad Museum, located at 7390 Mesa Road. You can find additional information on the museum at HoustonRRMuseum.org. This is KPFT Houston. Woo! Join DEA, serving South Asian victims of domestic violence, to celebrate their 14th anniversary and fundraiser gala, Seeds of Hope, taking place on Sunday, March 28th at 5 p.m., located at Chateau Crystal, 2517 Gessner Road, Houston, Texas, 77063. There will be a featured comedian, and Houston International Folk Dancers will be the featured performers. In 2009, DEA received nearly 4,000 calls for help and served 215 victims of domestic violence. All proceeds from the fundraiser will help DEA from the 2009 fire damage and resume full services to the victims of domestic violence, including owning and operating a transitional home. For more information, visit the website deahouston.org. This is KPFT Houston.
We've been at war with Iraq since 1990.
Saturday, March 20th, will be the 7th anniversary of the second war in Iraq, which has claimed the lives of hundreds of thousands of people. The war in Afghanistan, which has killed thousands more, will mark its 9th anniversary in the fall. On Saturday, March 20th, you can add your voice to the many across America demanding an end to these wars and funding for jobs, health.
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.